Possible in part by a grant from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, presenting musical artists Nancy Wilson and Ramsey Lewis, Ravi Shankar, Laurie Anderson, and Nathan Gunn in the coming weeks. For more information, contact the Krannert Center ticket office at 217-333-6280 or visit krannertcenter.com.
Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for your regular host, David Inge. Glad you could listen today. Producers of the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne is at the controls. Glad you're with us this morning. Since the defeat of the Clinton health care reform effort in 1994, the very idea of sweeping change in the American system of health care has been pretty much off the table. But over the past decade, the health of the health care system has only gotten worse. Some 45 million Americans now go without health insurance. The total cost of prescription drugs has exceeded $200 billion a year and is growing at several times the rate of inflation. Many Americans are increasingly worried about both the costs of health care and the way decisions are made about their health care services. During this election year, you might expect the presidential candidates would address these concerns with specific proposals. And indeed, George Bush and John Kerry have both articulated very different plans to extend health care benefits to more Americans. During this hour, Focus 580 will take a look at the health care plans of the presidential candidates and get some analysis of how they would affect the quality, affordability, and access to health care, health insurance, and prescription drugs, among other things. We have two guests with us who are part of a team of experts looking at the candidates' proposals to determine how they would play out if put into effect. Our guests are Jack Knott, director of the University of Illinois Institute of Government and Public Affairs, and Noreen Chagrou, senior research associate at the University of Illinois Nursing Institute and the Department of Public Health, Mental Health, and Administrative Nursing. Both of our scholars here in the studio and their departments are engaged in a wide range of research on key policy issues in health and social welfare, and they're with us this morning to put the focus on the health care policies we'll be voting for, along with the presidential candidates, on November 2nd. The conversation in this hour will also serve as a sort of preview of a panel discussion that will air on WILL-TV on Tuesday, October 5th, a town meeting-style program entitled Electing Healthcare from 7 to 8 p.m. Central Time. And that's right before the vice presidential debate, by the way, that evening. Electing Healthcare will feature presentations by representatives of both the Bush and Kerry campaigns on their healthcare proposals, followed by analysis from a panel of experts and questions from the studio audience. The program, Electing Healthcare, will be hosted by WILL's John Paul, and it'll also air on public TV and radio stations throughout Illinois, including AM 580, and I'm sure we'll mention it a bunch of times before October 5th. So that's the deal this hour of the show. If you would like to join us, all you have to do is pick up the telephone. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL if you match the letters with the numbers. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us around the Midwest. If you're listening on the Internet, anywhere in the continental U.S., 800-222-9455. Your questions are welcome. And to our guests, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Maybe to begin, I could ask you to sort of start with the outlines of the proposals of the presidential candidates and how they would deal with health care.
Well, we're going to talk primarily about the uninsured and access. And I think that it's a fair statement to say that both candidates have said they're concerned about the health of Americans. Both candidates don't want to see poor people not have health insurance. Both candidates have put out proposals, and each candidate has said the other is flawed, and both candidates are correct. And so that's sort of our starting point.
Begin with a paradox.
I guess, Jack, do you want to?
Sure. Let me start with Kerry Edwards. Their approach basically is focused on expanding Medicaid, especially for children and the parents of children who don't have health insurance now, as well as single adults who don't have children who are at or below the poverty line. So they have some specific proposals along those lines. One is in exchange for picking up the cost of Medicaid, the federal government would pick up the cost of Medicaid, which is now mostly shared with the states. They would enroll kids up to 300% of poverty. which is above what most states do now. There are a few states that do achieve that, maybe 8 to 10 states, something like that, but most states do not. So that would substantially expand the availability of Medicaid for through the SCHIP, the state health insurance program, to kids up to 300% of poverty. They'd also eliminate the 5-year waiting period for illegal pregnant immigrant women, because one of the issues is, as you will, if you look at the underinsured, it's heavily people who were born in other countries and people who are legal immigrants. They would also expand the coverage for working parents and single adults and childless adults up to 200% of poverty for these people, and they make them eligible for, again, state-based programs. Probably about 6 million adults are uninsured and live below the poverty line.
Jack, I think it's important at this point to also note that 80% of people who are uninsured are working families.
Mm-hmm, right.
These are not people who are not working and who are not participating in the economy. But most of the overwhelming majority of those people earn less than 200% of the federal poverty level.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so just sort of a mosaic of who these folks are is they are, in fact, contributing to the economic base of the country, but they do not have the resources to pay for health care.
That's correct. I guess the third part of the Carrie Edwards plan for expanding access to care is to make available the Federal Employees Health Benefits Program, which is the program that members of Congress now have, mm-hmm. and make that what they would do is set up a separate insurance pool that would be available to small businesses as well as large businesses and to individuals and families. And they would small businesses, for example, that would participate in this plan and make it available to their employees, they would provide tax credits. The employer would have to pay up to 50% of this, and then they would pay a tax credit up to the 50% of the cost as kind of an incentive. And they would focus this heavily on high-risk individuals. So they're going to create what's called a premium rebate pool, which is targeted at people who have high cost, healthcare cost, pay for them, and therefore hopefully lower the average cost to the other people. So those are really the three key approaches that mm-hmm. Carrie Edwards have put forward to expand coverage.
And the Bush-Cheney, before we get into that, I think it's important to note that there is some commonalities between these two approaches, mm-hmm. between the two candidates' approaches. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The first is both of them are proposing incremental increases. Both plans leave a large number of people still uninsured. The best estimates that are out there, sort of non-biased, non-campaign-driven estimates, under the Carey plan, you still end up with about 17.5 million people uninsured, and the Bush plan ranges from 27.5 to 34.5 million people still uninsured, and currently we're at about 45 million uninsured. The other thing is that both plans support the current market-driven employer-based health plans. There is not any attempt to dramatically overhaul the system, although Bush's plan or proposed plans actually come closest to making a dramatic change. And he's proposing to do that through these health associations, whereby people can band together and become a buying unit, essentially. And they are basically unconstrained units that can choose to offer health care in whatever form they want. They can provide some benefits and not others, and they can be driven by either faith-based initiatives, mm-hmm. political ideology, personal preferences, and that dramatically changes the way healthcare benefits are normally controlled, particularly insurance companies within states. States can mandate certain coverage, mm-hmm. and these actually take away that control from the states. Is that
Jack? Yeah, the Bush plan is really targeted at primarily at the fact that there are a large number of Americans who are working, whose employers do not provide health insurance, and a number of individuals between jobs, and a whole lot of circumstances in which people end up not being able to get health insurance. And so the basic approach, as Noreen has indicated, mm-hmm. is to create new insurance pools, primarily through two avenues. One is through these association plans mm-hmm. that Noreen just mentioned, which would be available for civic or charitable groups or faith-based groups, mm-hmm. Which now currently cannot offer health insurance. This would become possible for them to do. And there's actually one starting in Illinois.
Mm-hmm. Out of Peoria, mm-hmm. the Franciscans, the St. Francis Hospital in Peoria, is starting a faith-based initiative association. And they are not providing any reproductive or birth control services. Mm-hmm. Now, even personal care, which is in our local area, an option that employers and even people at the University of Illinois
sure.
have, they have been forced to figure out a payment mechanism so that women are in fact covered for reproductive services. Mm-hmm. And we're talking things like access to birth control. Mm-hmm. And these associations have none of those constraints on them.
So in other words, there's a flexibility in these plans to accommodate the moral and other issues involved with the charitable or faith-based organizations. The second is expanding association health plans for businesses. And these would create pool plans so that small businesses could join together and mm-hmm. Be able to offer a larger insurance pool for its individual employees. And businesses that have 5 to 10 people, it's very expensive. Mm-hmm. This would presumably reduce the cost of that.
The idea is they become a larger unit and can negotiate cheaper rates right. as a big employer does.
And then the other main thrust of the Bush-Cheney plan, in addition to these kind of association pools, is to encourage the creation of individual savings accounts, health savings account, HSAs. And this can be done through businesses or mm-hmm. by individuals, and they are providing fairly generous tax credits, both to individuals and to businesses who participate in these health savings accounts. The tax credits don't clearly come up to the full cost of health insurance, but they do provide an incentive.
And the other thing about that, they're not like the current pre-tax programs that now exist where you have to spend the money within a certain amount of time. Mm. These are, in fact, interest-bearing accounts, mm-hmm. and the money rolls over from year to year. The one thing before, again, we do a little bit more analysis of the Bush plan mm-hmm. is I think it's important to note that both of these plans have a complete disconnect to the realities of the way working poor people in particular, live. Mm-hmm. There isn't a sense that they understand the lives of these folks and what people need and what their true economic situation is. They're asking people who, on a daily basis, are pressured to find enough money to pay the rent and the utility bills mm-hmm. with rising costs to put aside money in a health savings account and not touch it. Now, when our utility bills go up, we have flexibility in our budgets as middle-class individuals, and we can pick and choose and juggle some things, and we don't always have to dip into savings account. If you're a working poor person, the flexibility in your budget is next to nothing. And so when the utility bill increases and you can't pay that, I think you're going to be extremely hard-pressed to leave money in a savings account for a health condition that might occur when the lights may be going off tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And there isn't a sense that working poor people do not have economic flexibility. And health savings accounts are great if you have a budget that allows you to move around and to move from category to category.
Right. Yeah, I agree with Noreen's general comment about some disconnect between poor people's actual lives and the kind of tax credits and deductions and savings accounts approach. The one exception to that, and Bush, Cheney have emphasized this in their plan, although Kerry Edwards have some emphasis on this as well. And that has to do with the expansion of the number of healthcare clinics, mm-hmm. Sort of neighborhood healthcare clinics that are supported by the federal government. The Bush-Cheney plan is proposing to expand those by about 1,200 new clinics that they estimate will cover over 6 million people. And these clinics, which are actually quite common in some cities, for example, Boston has over 20 community health clinics, and people who come to these clinics are accepted for care and are given care regardless of whether they have insurance. And there are some other cities, Washington, D.C. has some of these, but a number of places in the country don't. And this includes both rural areas as well as urban areas. So and that's personally, I think that's a exception to this general approach of tax rebates and savings.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think the expansion of the clinics in theory is a very good idea, but both Kerry Edwards and Bush Cheney have two problems that they haven't addressed. One is it's hard enough to staff these clinics as it is. There is no corollary plan to say, how do we staff these? Where are we going to get the nurse practitioner, the nurses, the dentists, the physicians, the physical therapist? The second thing is that Kerry Edwards says he's going to pay for this, say they're going to pay for this with a rollback of the tax credit for people earning more than $200,000. The problem is there are no actual estimates as to how much that would actually generate, at least not good estimates that aren't sort of campaign-driven. Bush-Cheney's problem is they have an ever-expanding deficit. They have two wars, essentially, going on. They have tax credits that they're not going to roll back, and yet they're going to expand health services. And there's no answer as to where that money is coming from. And I think both campaigns have not fairly said where the dollars are coming from and how much. And again, they haven't addressed the labor issue. And that is a non-trivial issue, particularly in the rural areas and even in urban areas with certain specialties. It's extremely difficult to get dentists and certain subspecialties of physicians to provide care.
Yeah.
And we have a nursing shortage. I mean, and they're not going to be paying the high level of salaries.
But we could, if we looked at those two plans as outlined now, the bottom line is, as Noreen mentioned earlier, the Kerry Edwards plan still leaves over 17 million people uninsured. So it's not, universal 100% coverage, but it reduces it from about 45 million, which is a substantial reduction. At some cost, about $650 billion cost is the estimate. The Bush-Cheney plan makes less strides in terms of reaching the uninsured. It estimated that it will reduce it maybe from 45 down to 35, 30 billion.
Maybe 27.
Maybe
depends
27 on the optimistic side. So it also has some substantial millions of people that would be covered that aren't covered before, but doesn't reduce it quite as much as the Kerry approach. On the other hand, the cost is presumably not as high. So that's kind of the bottom line with it. Neither approach is really going to give us universal health care, but both approaches do substantially improve the access to health care. Okay.
And we've also got to realize the context that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. Currently, about 20% of American children have no health insurance, and more than 25% of children are on Medicaid at some point during the year, and 63% of children who are Medicaid eligible are not on Medicaid. If you take that as an indicator of economic stability and family ability to access the healthcare system, we're in pretty bad shape, and neither of these plans really cut to the heart of that.
Okay. There's a lot to follow up on there, and we have a couple callers I want to include in our conversation. Let me quickly reintroduce our guests if people have joined us since the beginning of the show. We're talking about the health care plans of the presidential candidates, and we're getting some analysis of how they would affect the system and access to health care and a number of issues. Our guests are Jack Knott, director of the University of Illinois Institute of Government and Public Affairs, and Noreen Chagrou. She's a senior research associate at the University of Illinois Nursing Institute and the Department of Public Health, Mental Health, and Ministry of Nursing. And we have a couple callers to talk with, actually several callers lining up, and time for others. If you'd like to join us, I'll mention the number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. Quick follow-up question for Jack Knott before we take our first caller. We mentioned that the estimated cost of the Carey Edwards plan is about $650 billion, I guess. Is that what they're estimating, or is that sort of your analysis?
No, that is what they are estimating. It's included on their website, actually.
Okay. And has the Bush-Cheney campaign come up with a cost of their plan?
I haven't come across a specific figure like that. It certainly isn't on their website. It's not that it couldn't be estimated, but it's a little bit different kind of approach. It's not taking the government through Medicaid and expanding it, which would be easier to estimate.
Okay, fair enough. Well, let's talk with some listeners. First up, a caller in Indiana on line number 4. Good morning.
Hi.
Yes.
The problem, it seems to me, in runaway medical costs is medical insurance. In other words, medical insurance is not the solution. Medical insurance is the problem because it creates a situation where there is no incentive to control medical costs. Since most medicine is something that virtually everybody needs, any medical insurance should have a very high deductible. So that almost always the people who get the medical treatment should pay the bill. That way, there is an incentive that they can go looking for the lowest prices. The way it is now, if you go into a hospital, at least when I was in the hospital, I checked some prices. I paid $52 per gallon for intravenous fluids. This intravenous fluid was a saline solution. That is salt water, weak salt water. $52 a gallon. They had an intravenous fluid they called D5W. It's weak sugar water, and its price is over $1,000 a gallon.
Okay, I think we take your point that essentially healthcare insurance is a mechanism that violates the principles of the free market. I mean, what would you say about that?
Well, I think before we answer that, it's important to note that for people who are insured, the per capita spending in this country mm-hmm. is $2,975 per year on medical costs. Mm-hmm. For the uninsured, the per capita spending is $1,629. So on a per capita basis, we are actually not spending large amounts of money. What you have are pockets of times in our lives when we use a lot of health care, mm-hmm. and that those dollars accrue to small groups of people at any given time.
Well, I think the caller makes a really important point about third-party payment. When you don't have to pay for it directly yourself, there's mm-hmm. less of an incentive to worry about what the cost is. That is changing as we speak. There are many more businesses and nonprofit organizations and government that are increasing the copay. That's a strong mm-hmm. trend. Mm-hmm. Yes. And indeed, with the weakening of managed care that occurred through actions of Congress in several of the states, the response by businesses and government has basically been to try to increase the copay. So we are moving in that direction. The concern is in the U.S. as compared to some other countries is in the other countries, the public sector of the healthcare system is larger than it as a proportion of the total healthcare system that it is in the U.S. And they have generally been able to impose a national budget on how much could be spent, which it creates the kinds of queues and waiting in line and so on that that we read about, like mm-hmm. in Canada and elsewhere. So that's a concern if we're going to take that route. The approach of giving people the option of paying more and more of it themselves is more of a market-driven approach. I have two concerns about that. One is the way our system works, it's very difficult to know in advance what various medical procedures are going to cost or to estimate what they should cost and to make reasonable kind of market comparisons. You usually get these bills, months after you've had this. And so how do you make a normal economic judgment whether you should have a procedure or not? It's not a normal, it's not like going into the store and comparing prices of tennis shoes or anything like that. Secondly, the cost is very high. It's like something like $10,000 per person, on an annual basis, if we include all the costs that the employer pays, et cetera. It's very difficult for a large portion of the population to pay very much of that, especially poor people. So it has an unequal effect. Certainly the middle class, upper middle class can pay this increasing co-pays. There'd have to be, it seems to me, some gradation by income and addressing the inequality issue with regard to that.
Yeah, well, those are all good points. One other sort of question I'd like to raise before we get on to the other callers is, in addition to that, isn't there a public value or a public good that relates to healthcare? That isn't, if we say it's all up to the individual, we don't care if people are healthy or not, doesn't that affect the public health?
Yeah, that's an excellent point as well. Healthcare, by all accounts, has many spillover benefits to the society in general. When you have a healthy workforce, your economy is more productive. Students do better in school. Communities function better. There's a huge benefit to society beyond just the individual benefits that people get from getting health or medical care. And that public benefit is usually not captured in prices. And that's one of the reasons that in every country in the world, the government is very heavily involved in health care. And so you would underproduce health care to a substantial degree if you just had it all privately or individually paid.
Very good. A couple of callers waiting. We'll get on next to, I believe, a listener in Chicago on line number one. Good morning.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I think your discussion has just proven something I've always suspected, that neither one of these candidates have any concern for the poor. And really, since Johnson's war on poverty, there has never been since then any program directed towards helping the poor. In fact, each single administration has been chiseling away at these programs and focusing their attention on the middle class, often taking money out of programs for the poor to help the middle class. The other comment is that we need some fundamental decisions that we have to make as a country. If we're going to tie our health insurance program to a job, then we have to make employers responsible to ensure that all of their workers have health insurance. We allow companies such as Walmart to systematically give people less than 40 hours of weekly employment so that they are not required to give them health insurance. So you have people, like you said, 30 working 34 hours, 38 hours a week and not having any health insurance. And the final thing I think we need to decide as a country is if health care should be a free market issue, because as you said, if we develop, like the Soviet Union has, antibiotic-resistant tuberculosis strand, then our entire country suffers. So those type of questions no one really looks at, and I think that before you can create plans, you really need to look at what's your goal and what's your philosophy. I mean, I can understand that cosmetic surgery such as breast augmentation might be something that should be at the free market. But for someone, breast reduction might be a real health issue, and that should not be free market. That is simply ensuring the health of your citizenry.
Okay. Well,
I think the caller makes a very good point that as a nation, we have not had the discussion and the dialogue about what is the role of health care. We've had it incrementally. There are court cases which have said health care is, in fact, not a right. And both of these candidates in their proposals seem to be reflecting a commitment to the market and to employer-based insurance.
Yeah, I think that's correct. part of this is a political calculation as well. I mean, the Clinton plan would have replaced much of the current market arrangements with a managed care that would be heavily government regulated, and it was in the end, soundly defeated, and was a huge political issue for the Clinton administration. Both of these plans attempt to take the employer-based system that we have and expand it. And we have one of the most complicated healthcare systems in the world, in which we actually have we spend approximately as a percent of GNP or GDP, 80 to 90% more than other industrialized countries, so that our public sector is actually as large as most public sectors in other countries. Most other countries spend 7 or 8% on healthcare in total, and most of that is public. We also spend 7 to 8% of our GDP on healthcare through the public sector. It's just that we have this enormously large private sector as well. So both plans are building on this complex segmented system and are trying to expand it incrementally. The one area where I do disagree a little bit in that both parties and both candidates have put forward efforts to expand coverage for the poor, to expand the children's health insurance program to include individuals who are at or near the poverty line, et cetera. The problem is that given their premise of starting with the employer-based system, it's very difficult then to get up to universal coverage through these incremental approaches.
I also think that Jack's point about the political realities, we are still reeling politically from the Clinton health plan. Take, for example, the Bush campaign charges that Kerry's plan is nothing more than the Clinton plan recycled. Actually, that's not true. If you're going to accuse the Kerry people of recycling anything, it comes closest to sort of recycling the Bill Bradley plan, where he was going to use the federal insurance system. But that notion that we're tinkering with the health system and that it's almost Clinton-like and changing too much is something I think most candidates fear those charges.
Just a quick question to make sure that I understood correctly, and I think we had a call off the air asking this very question about the Kerry Edwards plan. Did I understand correctly that it would expand Medicaid so that those families earning, I think you said, three times the federal poverty level?
That the 300% of poverty level is for the children.
Okay.
It would be automatically enroll children through the school. When they would go to school in the fall, they would automatically be enrolled in this program up to 300% of poverty. For their parents, it does that only up to 200% of poverty. And for single adults or childless couples, it's just up to the poverty level. So those are the figures.
The thresholds, okay.
Yeah,
and the poverty level, I believe, is currently, for a family of four, something like $25,000 income a year or something like that.
A little bit less than
that. Yeah, it's around 23, I think.
Okay.
24.
I hope that clarifies that for that listener, and we'll go on and talk with some more folks. Our lines are full. We'll go next to someone in Champaign County on line number 2. Good morning.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I won't join in the attack on market-based solutions to the economy, except to say that it's not so easy to knock off to Walmart and buy the cheapest plasma, and that this crazy Calvinism that it's your own fault if you're sick is just obscene. So I guess I did join in.
Okay.
But you're mainly examining the federal level. That's important, but I wonder if you have some words to say about the health justice bill, which I was happily surprised to hear has been passed and signed in Illinois, and that it will give us venues for informed citizenry to actually have an outlet for discussing this. And maybe this discussion will be at least joined at this level. That was one point. I'm going to spit out a couple more and then hang up and listen.
Okay.
That's okay.
Sure.
If we look at what the Medicare so-called reform that's just been crafted has done, it hasn't done much for seniors. They're not happy with it, but you can talk about these health care savings bills that are projected by the Bush administration, but what the Medicare bill was dump a lot of money into HMOs, something like $45 million, and I think any other solution that's going to come from Bill Frist dominated Senate, as it were, who is with HCA, one of the biggest HMOs in the country, is going to have a similar kind of outline where there's some window dressing of some kind of private initiative, but dumping money into corporate and solidifying this privatization, and maybe eventually going towards taking bids on your plasma will come about instead of some kind of humane system that does say the state has responsibility for the health care of its citizens on some levels.
Okay.
And I'll hang up and listen what some other people get in. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
I think the caller makes a point about some of the conflict of interest in the legislation and who's driving the legislation. And we just have to sort of either fight that or sit back and take a watch and wait attitude. And it depends on your political persuasion.
If I understood the question about the drug benefit for the through Medicare, to me, there are two difficulties I have with it. One is its complexity. It has such different benefits depending on how much you're spending, and it kicks in at different times, et cetera, that I think it's been confusing for the elderly to actually know what it is that they're getting out of this plan that was passed. And secondly, it leaves a large gap. It covers approximately 25% or so of a lower cost up to $22.50 a year. And then from that up to about $5,000 a year, it covers nothing. And then after that, it pays almost all of it. So it's kind of like a catastrophic coverage primarily. It doesn't really address the many elderly who are paying less than $5,000, but even if you're paying less than $5,000, that's a huge burden on a lot of elderly people who are on fixed incomes and don't have as much.
Just a footnote to the Medicare issue: we will be doing a program with Robert Kaplan from the U of I College of Richard Kaplan. I'm sorry. Somebody wrote that down wrong. Must have been me. Richard Kaplan will be on the show on September 28th at 11 o'clock to talk about Medicare. And so we'll go more in depth on that issue at that time. We have lines full, so I want to go on and talk with some more callers. And I will give the caller from Chicago a chance to follow up, but I want to take things in the order in which they appear here. Next, Lovington, line number 4. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes.
I just want to make the observation, I guess, that all this privatization talk and about how everything's going to be competitive, I think that assumes that people actually shop that way, and I'm not sure they do. I think there's been a lot of research to show that, for some reason, people really a lot of times don't go for the best deal. There's a lot of other things going on, and it seems to me like a lot of the privatization, not only in healthcare, I know that's what you're talking about right now, so just, but in healthcare is just the government's picking up is really the healthcare. I mean, they're providing healthcare for a bunch of people in this country right now off tax money, and we're just allowing the insurance companies to cherry pick the people who can pay them.
The caller makes a valid point. The government at this point pays for uninsured people, the government is picking up $26.3 billion this year alone in uncompensated care for people who are uninsured. Awful lot of money.
That occurs primarily through people going to hospitals. And the hospitals get a compensation through Medicaid if they have a disproportionate number of uninsured people in their clientele.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot to follow up on there. I guess one of the questions that I have real quickly, I'll ask it and then we'll get on to some more callers. Under the Bush-Cheney plan, the association health plans, these new entities that would be established statutory allowed to be established, to enable people to pool and set up different kinds of healthcare plans. This is another situation where I'm not sure how that would play out, and maybe you could talk about this. It seems, number one, to maybe add to the complexity of the healthcare system by having yet another series of layers of different kinds of plans that then involve different layers of administration.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that is the I strongly feel that one of the difficulties we have with our healthcare system is its complexity. And people who find themselves in changing jobs or going through different life phases and so on have a hard time figuring out how to get coverage in those conditions because it's so complex. And even finding out about what is available in the state of Illinois is not easy to do, even for, people are educated and want to look into it. So this would add an additional type of insurance through these faith-based organizations. It would add a variety of different types of coverage. Some of it would cover some things, some cover others. And then you'd have also these pools through the small businesses. So it would add to the complexity of the healthcare system.
Here's where there is one striking difference between the two candidates. Kerry Edwards have clearly said they do not support the creation of these associations. Bush Cheney are putting a lot of emphasis on these associations, and that's how they're saying access is going to be increased. What Kerry Edwards is saying is let people use the tax credit. He, too, has this tax credit idea, but they buy into an already existing system, the federal system. So in that sense, there is a real significant difference, and Kerry Edwards are not allowing expansion of the bureaucracy, a sort of multiplication of providers and paperwork.
Yeah, the other aspect of that is if you look at overhead costs in our country compared to other countries, we're substantially above most countries that have a simpler system, especially single-payer systems. It's estimated that in the private sector, for example, overhead costs range between 15% and 30% of premiums for insurance companies, which is substantially above the overhead costs for Medicaid, for example, which is, our one single-payer kind of system from the federal government, and much above what the overhead costs are in European or Canada and so on. So adding an added complexity here, this is only going to increase those overhead costs further.
Okay. Well, we have several callers here, and I'm probably being a little too quick on the trigger here because I want to make sure to include everybody. Our last caller did want to ask how much healthcare is paid by the public and how much private in the United States. Do we have a general idea of the...
We spend about 14, almost 15% of our GDP on healthcare now, $1.6 trillion. It's a pretty even split, almost 50-50 is provided through private insurance, et cetera, and the other 50 is provided through the government. Now, that estimate is skewed a little bit since it doesn't take into account the fact that there's a huge tax subsidy that goes on to businesses. I mean, we actually pay this, but when you don't pay taxes on the health insurance premiums that the University of Illinois or other employers pay, so that's a subsidy, an indirect tax subsidy by the federal government. And if you add that in and some other tax subsidies of that type, in fact, the public sector pays almost 60% of health care in the U.S.
And let's remember that tax subsidy is regressive in the sense that we're subsidizing people who make very substantial incomes to have their health insurance paid.
Yes.
And those who don't get the health care insurance don't get the subsidy.
Exactly. Yeah. But the tax dollars are being used to, in fact, subsidize insurance premium.
It's like our housing policy, where the bigger house you buy and the more expensive, the bigger your subsidy is. It's a regressive kind of tax.
Okay. We have several calls here, and I promised to let the Chicago listener follow up. Line number one. Good morning.
Thank you. You already almost answered it. My question was that is much of our cost, the fact that we have such a high number of health administrators per capita instead of health providers per capita, and is anyone talking about cutting through that layer between the medicine being provided and the provider and the patient and all of that bureaucracy that it just seems to be keep multiplying every time we do a program? And this is in the private sector, even without the government being involved.
As long as there is a market-driven, employer-based system with multiple providers in the market, including the government, the bureaucracy is going to be there, and it is going to be very difficult to cut back that bureaucratic level. The Carey Edwards plan doesn't cut it back, but it doesn't seem to dramatically add to it because they're proposing to only use one payer to increase access. The Bush Cheney plan would dramatically increase the amount of bureaucracy and paperwork and administrators who have to administer these multiple associations.
Thank you.
Both campaigns do have a section in which they are trying to improve the efficiency of this. And part of it is incentives for providers and insurance companies to use electronic records. The Bush campaign has put a strong emphasis on that, but Carey has now bought into that as well. There's also in both campaigns an effort to put some control on malpractice costs. They take a different approach to that, but that's a very expensive process as well. So they do have a set of recommendations for streamlining the complexity, but it's mostly through technology, improvements in technology and processing and record keeping and things like that.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. We have about 6 minutes left and a couple callers here. I will try to get them both in. We'll go next to a listener in Belgium on line number 3. Good morning.
Hello. I'll be quick here. Maybe I'm being extremely naive in putting this so simple, but if the rest of the world is cheaper in a lot of ways, why do we want to go to somebody else's plan? Why don't we just use what they use?
Well,
politics 101.
That's what I thought. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Well, there is a bit of a trade-off, as I mentioned earlier. The U.S. is unique in the sense that we spend more per capita on healthcare than any other country. It's way far above. So, on the other hand, we don't reach as many people as other countries do in terms of coverage or access to care, and that's kind of where the trade-off occurs. If we were to increase or change our system, say to a single payer system like Canada or Britain have, or something like that, it would create waiting lines and so on if we were to reduce the amount of spending to the same per capita that they spend.
So. Although I suspect poor people will tell you they wait a long time if they can even get preventive services.
That's exactly right. I mean, you can go to the emergency,
go to Francis Nelson.
If you really want to learn about our healthcare system, go to the emergency rooms in big cities, and you'll see the whole range of healthcare provided and long waiting lines and
very inefficient.
Inefficient.
Mm-hmm. Yes. We have another caller waiting patiently on line number 2 in Savoy. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yeah. Hi. How you doing?
Good.
Hey, I was just doing some simple arithmetic. You know, to have $1 million in the bank at the end of 75 years at 5% interest, you only have to deposit $1,321 a year. And so, you know, what insurance is saving money for, is having the insurance company or the pool save money for a rainy day. And basically what's going on is in the healthcare industry, you do not have people operating like insurance companies waiting for that rainy day to come. And by and large, even though healthcare is very unpredictable, it is possible to go and figure out how much money you need in your piggy bank at the end of a certain time, and you can pretty much predict when you're going to start using it. And so for every $1 million of coverage, you don't have to pay that much. And the thing that just kind of boggles my mind is really what you need is some legislation that holds these people to the fire and said, hey, you're gonna have a real insurance company. And why is that so difficult to obtain?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Well, insurance companies work by, they assess the risk, and they say, hey, if the risk is $1 million over a certain period of time, they've got to
save that much money.
Yeah, you've got to save that money. Now, basically, these health care companies do not do that. They're not insurance companies because they don't save the money. And so on and so forth. If you would force them to do that, they would have the money, and the insurance premiums would be reasonable.
You're talking about the insurance companies saving the money?
No, I'm talking about if you want $1 million.
Or are you talking about businesses, employers?
If you've got a risk of $1 million over a certain period of time, you can calculate how much money you have to deposit every year to cover that risk within a certain certainty.
So you're talking about employers?
No, I'm talking about just how much money do you have to put into a fund to cover a certain risk. Okay? And whenever you calculate how much money that is at a given risk and a given interest rate, for $1 million over 70 years at a 5% interest rate, you only have to deposit $1,321 a year.
The problem is health care is not predictable. People who didn't think they were at risk prior to the HIV epidemic for catastrophic coverage would not have been covered under, for example, his plan. The problem with health care is you don't know how much you're going to use, and you don't know exactly when you're going to use it.
Yeah. And I'm sorry to say that we've kind of scratched the surface of this topic in this hour, and we're out of time. But we will continue talking about these issues. I hope that, I think that you did an excellent job of sort of laying out the outlines of the plans, and hopefully people can take something away from that. And are there some resources that people can maybe get more information from offhand? I mean, the websites of the candidates are one source.
Kaiser Family Foundation, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, any of the big foundations will have analyses of the healthcare plan. And of course, Electing Healthcare will have their own website where
That's
we provide analysis.
Yeah, this program we mentioned a couple of times on October 5th, Electing Healthcare on WILL-TV. We broadcast statewide, and there will be a website, electinghealthcare.org, associated with that. It's not up yet, but I know that people are working on that. So,
and there will be a paper analyzing the two plans on various issues, including the uninsured and access.
Very good. We'll have to leave it there. Our guests have been Jack Knott, Director of the University of Illinois Institute of Government and Public Affairs, and Noreen Chagrou, Senior Research Associate at the University of Illinois Nursing Institute. To both of you, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Jack.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Lincoln Square Mall in Urbana, with more than a dozen shops, businesses, and restaurants, including Art Mart, Art Mart Toys, and Boyer Drawing and Painting, producer of murals, scenic art, and faux finishing classes. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by Eastern Rug Gallery at 1402 South Neal Street in Champaign. Eastern Rug Gallery offers a collection of guaranteed hand-knotted Oriental and Persian rugs of all sizes, made of pure wool or silk pile, designed to add beauty to any decor, whether homes or offices.
That's it for this hour of Focus 580. When we return in just a few minutes, we'll be speaking with Dr. Marcia Angel, author of the book The Truth About Drug Companies, How They Deceive Us and What to Do About It, another healthcare topic. First, we'll take a break for some news and a market update. Here's Jay Pierce.
Thank you very much, Jack. Well, good weather and good harvests are turning prices lower on the Chicago Board of Trade, a seventh consecutive day of new contract lows in the corn pits. First of all, let's look at December wheat, currently trading at 328, down 5.25. March also down 5.25 at 338.5. December corn, 213.5, down 1.75. March, 223.25, down 2. May,